Thank you, Lee, and Bill Campbell. It's an honor to be here to pay tribute to the fine work of Paul Hollander. I've used his work in my classes at Grove City College, as I know some of my colleagues have, and of course in my research for years. And here today I'd like to focus on three related aspects of his work. One, anti-communism. Two, political pilgrims, and then three, of course, anti-Americanism, sort of culminating in that third point. First, on anti-communism, one of my favorite articles by Hollander was this May 1994 piece in National Review. In fact, before I left the office yesterday, I went and grabbed this from my lecture folder. I actually have my students read this. It's an advantage of a Grove City College education. We actually have them read articles like this. And this piece, the cover says, the Holocaust that we excused. And the article inside, the title is Soviet Terror, American Amnesia. And I'd like to just read a few quotes, a few passages from this. Hollander began, it has been customary in our times to make reference to the Holocaust whenever we wish to allude to some unrivaled evil. The Holocaust became the undisputed reference point for self-evident evil, and for good reason. By the same token, words like Nazi, Auschwitz, stormtroopers, and Gestapo are reflexively appended to political and social phenomena that we wish to discredit conclusively, right? And justifiably so. It rarely happens, however, that self-evident evil is denoted by reference to the mass murders committed in the Soviet Union under Stalin. Words like Soviet, Soviet Communist, Kalima, KGB are rarely used to discredit political movements and practices. It is doubtful that 1 in 1,000 Americans know what Kalima was or would recognize the name of a single Soviet concentration camp. And there were thousands of them. There were more Soviet concentration camps than there were Nazi concentration camps. It's just as likely that 1 in 1,000 Americans has never heard the names of Beria, or others like him. In Lawrence Reese's new book, World War II Behind Closed Doors, he has Stalin, now a declassified document, Stalin talking to a German official, and he introduces Beria as R. Himmler. And of course, everyone in America knows who Himmler, well, a lot of people know who Himmler is, but people don't even know who Beria was. And Beria is arguably an even more despicable figure than Himmler was in some ways. Hollander continues, and again, this is 1994, there have been no television documentaries of the Gulag, not on public television, CNN, or the networks. Russian television programs about these mass murders have not been shown on American television. No Hollywood movie has attempted to show any aspect of Soviet repression and terror. And he writes, with a partial exception of Dr. Zhivago, and that's nowhere close. Right, I mean, where is the Soviet version of Schindler's List, right? So he tries to explain this. He goes through a number of different reasons in this article explaining why this double standard, you know, why we don't talk about, you know, why we don't talk about the Soviets in the same way that we do the Nazis. And he gives the example. His answer is, among others, anti-communism. He quotes Michael Parenti. Parenti wrote this about anti-communism. It is patriotic hooliganism, collective self-delusion, the propagation of political orthodoxy, the imprisonment of dissenters, and the emergence of a gargantuan military establishment. That's anti-communism. Abroad, anti-communism has brought us armament races, nuclear terror, the strengthening of oppressive autocracies, the death and maiming of American boys, and the slaughter of far-off offending peoples. It has brought us grief and shame. Now, Hollander adds this. In the anti-communist position, two contradictory attitudes came together. On the one hand, it was perfunctorily acknowledged that communist systems, or some of them, were bad, but asserted that this did not justify dwelling on their shortcomings. On the other hand, anti-communist attitudes were denounced as an obsession, a fantasy, a phobia, a pathology, and a metaphor for everything that was wrong with the American system. I think he's exactly right on this. We don't hear about it enough. If I could add my personal take on anti-communism in the academy, I think it's even worse in the academy than it is in Hollywood or probably any other aspect of American life. I mean, the academics, we've seen surveys on this, 80 to 90% self-identify liberal, especially in the social sciences and the humanities. You rarely ever get anything higher than 10% self-identified as conservative. And this anti-communism pervades in liberal circles. I think what we're seeing among academics, radical left academics, is in most cases not so much pro-communism, although we do see that, but a very strong dislike and indeed an antipathy for anti-communists and anti-communism. They see anti-communists as a sort of Neanderthal nascent Joe McCarthy's. I come across this again and again. James Burnham had the great line about how for the left, the preferred enemy is always to the right. I think that's so true here too. I noticed that Dr. Richard Pipes is here presenting today, and I talked to Dr. Pipes when he was at Grove City College back in 2005, and I asked him about this whole double standard and anti-communism. I asked, quote, "Academic historians have done an extremely thorough, commendable job documenting the horrors and crimes of fascist Nazis, but not communist Bolsheviks. Why is that?" And Pipes' answer, "This is quite true, and the answer is difficult. One reason is that many of them, these academic historians, politically agree, at least in theory, with many of the goals of communists. Equal distribution of wealth and income equality, for example. Certainly, this is one reason. In practice, though, they, communist regimes, achieved none of this. In practice, it was sheer barbarism." And I asked him, what about the anti-communism? He says, yes, that's quite right. Academics consider anti-communism and anti-communists to be vulgar and simple-minded. There are very few communists among these academics, but many, many anti-communists. Plus, they say they need to be impartial in dealing with the Bolsheviks, for example, rather than condemning them in their scholarship, which in actual effect, in practice, can mean being actually supportive. They were rightly partial in dealing with Auschwitz, while in many cases ignoring the Gulag. I personally will get invited, I'll get sponsored by Young America's Foundation, or ISI, to speak on college campuses across the country, and I get these desperate emails from college Republican groups saying, could you please come here and give a talk on why communism is bad? And I give this sort of standard 30-minute talk where I lay out all the repressions of basic civil liberties, all the people killed, the Gulag and everything else, and you can see that the young people in the room, they're riveted. They're hearing all of this for the first time. And if any of their liberal professors show up, which they rarely do, but when they do, they just stare at me with like daggers coming out of their eyes, as if the ghost of Joe McCarthy has flown into the room and leapt inside of my body. Right? They're horrified at what I'm doing. So I think this was one of Hollander's more important contributions, and I think one of the not acknowledged as much as some of his other writings. Second point on political pilgrims, which is, I refer to them as Potemkin progressives. These folks are rooted mainly in the 1920s, 1930s. 1920s, the first full decade after the communist takeover in Russia in 1917. The Comintern, founded in Moscow in March of 1919. The American Communist Party, founded in Chicago in September of 1919. And it just happened to dovetail with the progressive movement and the rise of the progressive movement in the United States. So many American progressives were intensely intrigued by what was going on in the Soviet Union. Hollander talks about this, describes it, as Lee Edwards said, an intense alienation among American leftists that drew them to the Soviet Union. But I think it was more than that. For one thing, they thought that the Soviets were perhaps charting a brave new world, and that they had this new system based on the collective redistribution of wealth, workers' rights, classless utopia. And in a lot of cases with the progressives, it's a matter of goals and it's a matter of degree. They might not take all of the wealth and collectivize everything and nationalize everything and redistribute everything, but they would do it to some degree. And so they fellow travelers on a shared common road. Now, in addition to that, the Soviets, who had the whole Potemkin village, they would, Lenin and Stalin both, their goal in inviting a lot of these progressives over to the Soviet Union, and this is not acknowledged enough, was that they wanted the progressives to go back to the United States, raving about what they discovered, and asking the administrations, first Woodrow Wilson, then the Republicans in the 20s, and then ultimately FDR, they wanted the United States and the West to diplomatically recognize Russia. That was a major part of this. So if they could get these progressives to come home and talk about this wonderful world that they discovered in Russia, they might urge diplomatic recognition. Well, so many of these folks, these visitors, educators, academics, journalists, union organizers, were totally taken, totally duped by what they discovered there. A few examples that Hollander gives that I've cited. H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells, after meeting Stalin, quote, "I've never met a man more candid, fair, and honest. Everyone trusts him." Everyone trusts him. By the way, he said the same thing about Vladimir Lenin, who he called a frank, refreshing, and amazing little man who had almost persuaded me to share his vision. That's what he said. H.G. Wells. George Bernard Shaw, who had a personal meeting with Stalin, came back and said this, "We in the West cannot afford to give ourselves moral airs when our most enterprising neighbor," that would be the Soviet Union, "humanely and judiciously liquidates a handful of exploiters and speculators to make the world safe for honest men." He actually said that. Shaw not only praised Stalin and his utilitarian killing, as he put it, but the various Stalin henchmen who cranked the wheels of the killing machine, such as Felix Dzerzhinsky. His statements on the five-year plans, everything else is just incomprehensible, stunning. Malcolm Muggeridge, who was there at the time and not taken by this, unlike Walter Durante of the New York Times and some others, and Muggeridge at that point was a man on the left, right? Muggeridge was over there. He had some of these Potemkin village tours, taken to atheist museums and so forth. And Muggeridge was stunned at how his fellow leftists were, again, duped repeatedly. Muggeridge wrote this, speaking of the progressives, "They are unquestionably one of the wonders of the age, and I shall treasure till I die as a blessed memory the spectacle of them traveling with radiant optimism through a famished countryside, wandering in happy bands about squalid, overcrowded towns, listening with unshakable faith to the fatuous patter of carefully trained and indoctrinated Soviet guides, repeating like schoolchildren a multiplication table the bogus statistics and mindless slogans endlessly intoned to them." He added this, "Among them, there were earnest advocates of the humane killing of cattle who looked upon the massive headquarters of the OGPU with tears of gratitude in their eyes. Earnest advocates of proportional representation who eagerly assented when the necessity of the dictatorship of the proletariat was explained to them. Earnest clergymen who walked reverently through anti-God museums and reverently turned the pages of atheistic literature. Earnest pacifists who watched delightedly tanks rattle across Red Square and bombing planes darken the sky. Earnest town planning specialists who stood outside overcrowded, ramshackle Soviet tenements and muttered, 'If only we had something like this in England.'" And not only was Muggeridge amazed by this, but so were the Soviets. So were the Soviets. Muggeridge said, "The almost unbelievable credulity of these mostly university-educated tourists astonished even Soviet officials used to handling foreign visitors." And he said these people were by and large progressives. "These fellow passengers provided my first experience of the progressive elite from all over the world who attached themselves to the Soviet regime, resolved to believe almost anything they were told by its spokesman. They were upholders of progressive causes and members of progressive organizations." Ecstatic about playing a part in this drama of the 20th century, ready at any moment to rush on stage, cheering and gesticulating, a Western version of the devotees of Krishna who throw themselves under the wheels of the great juggernaut. That was Muggeridge. Two other examples, quickly. I'm running out of time, right? Okay. Corliss Lamont, who was the son of New York banker Thomas Lamont, chairman and partner at J.P. Morgan, he went there in 1932 with his wife, Margaret. They came back. They wrote a book called Russia Day by Day. They were transported from town to town in Lincoln 8 limousines by the Soviets. And when they came back, they wrote about this in their book. And the Lamonts said this: "Some of the Americans object strongly and assert that this is the naive Soviet way of impressing visitors, right? But it is not. It is not. They're not going to be taken." They describe going to Lenin's tomb, July 16, 1932. Lamont: "Lenin's face is strong, calm, and refined in the fundamental sense. His hand rests on a red pillow, and his hands, clasped on his chest in a tranquil way, appear delicate and intellectual. The short yet forceful beard is reddish. We have to keep moving, though we want to stop longer and look more and more carefully. It is not enough. It is not enough." So they get back in line. They pay homage, taking strength from Lenin's impersonally beautiful and resolute face, which seems perfectly natural and wholly desirable. The Lamonts, when they came back, described a great deal of happiness, and then they urged in the final pages of their book diplomatic recognition for Soviet Russia. One more example, quickly. John Dewey, who was Lamont's mentor at Columbia. And Dewey took his pilgrimage in 1928, along with educators from 25 different American universities. And he, too, laughed at, quote, "this warning that appears humorous in retrospect, so often given by kindly friends, that we would be taken to show places by the Soviets." And he said that wasn't the case at all. But he was taken to show places. He came back. He wrote a 6-part series for the New Republic, which ran from November to December 1928. And you can still get it, and you should read it. It's amazing to see. And he said in here, "my mind was in a whirl of new impressions. Readjustment was difficult, and I lived somewhat dazed. The outstanding fact is that Russia is in a revolution," said John Dewey, "involving a release of human powers on such an unprecedented scale that it is of incalculable significance, not only for that country, but for the world." He said that the Bolshevik Revolution is a great experiment and a great success, despite secret police, inquisitions, arrests, and deportations of netmen and kulaks, exiling of party opponents, including divergent elements in the party, and so forth. That's John Dewey. And then his final article for the New Republic, he wrote this: "political recognition of Russia is a crucial part of what must happen for the United States. And I went to Russia with no conviction on that subject, but he came back convinced of it." There's other cases: Upton Sinclair, Margaret Sanger, Paul Hollander has covered this, and I'm out of time, but I give you examples post-September 11th as well. Just to wrap up, Paul Hollander on anti-Americanism is what I've described here: political pilgrims, anti-communism. Is this anti-Americanism? In some cases, yes. Not in all cases. At the very least, though, what you're seeing is an anti-American exceptionalism. No question about that. You know, these folks don't see America in the Reagan-esque way as the beacon, the shining city upon a hill. You know, Reagan spoke of America as, quote, less of a place than an idea. And these folks don't see the country that way. It's a complicated and disturbing subject. Paul Hollander has looked into it as well, if not better, than anybody else. He understands the political psychology and the perversities here. And what he's diagnosed, unfortunately, still remains with us long after the end of the Cold War. Thanks.